This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's chucking down outside and Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, is in the studio with us. It's a Friday.
Drenched.
Yes, you are, George. Literally, he isn't making it up. He's all wet. and we have a very interesting topic today. I felt that it was there was a need because I needed to understand this difference between Obamacare and Trump care. I mean, this has been so much said about, you know, Trump in the media. And, you know, there have been some stuff that he's saying coming through about the healthcare system as well. Some of which is, you know, in a way, very contrary to what Obamacare was all about. And there are some concerns. So we have called in the expert to help us make sense of this. Azra Muhammad Khalif, he's Manager for External Relations from the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, better known as IDEAS. It's very much a think tank. We usually have one on the show. He clearly said Azra is really the guy you should be speaking to. So
such a burden responsibility.
He just tai chi'd off that to you.
Very smart.
So anyway, we're going to kickstart with, I think, a very basic question. I would say it's 101, Obamacare versus Trump care for dummies, really.
Yeah, that's like
okay. How would you...
No, Obamacare and Trump care for George Lee.
Yes.
Because, you know, I had
also,
no idea. That's
okay.
Right.
How would you, for those of us who don't quite understand, what are the differences really, Azra?
Well, before I begin, perhaps I should start with a caveat. Anybody who's calling themselves expert about American healthcare is very much fibbing.
Right, alternative facts.
Yeah, well, it could be alternative facts, but it's also just a few days old, really. And everybody's trying to digest what exactly will it mean for the average American. And certainly the Congressional Budget Office has put out analysis concerning, you know, how it will. But let's just start with the basics first. Basically, any healthcare system for a particular country will need to be financed by something. Whether it's private or public funds, it needs to be financed. You have your hospitals, you have your clinics, and doctors needing to be paid, nurses and so forth. So
and medications, interventions, and that sort of thing. That's right.
And treatment, surgeries, all this needs to be paid somehow. And what the American healthcare system has been very much concerned about over the past three decades, really, is how to fund and sustain the existing healthcare system that they have today.
Just to to interrupt just very quickly, I think one of the things we always talk about on this show as well when it comes to healthcare spending is that the healthcare spending as a share of GDP in America is about 17%. The healthcare spending versus against as a share of GDP in Malaysia is only 4%, I think.
That's always...
And I think the recommendation is it should be at least 5% and more.
The Ministry of Health would say it's 4.8% of GDP.
It's still below 5.
Yeah, it's still below 5. And certainly for an upper middle income country like Malaysia, it should really be 5. When you look at in terms of 17.8% GDP for the US at $3.2 trillion versus Malaysia's around $52 billion, it really isn't that comparable, really, in terms. But certainly one of the things that we need to be able to be improving upon is how much money is allocated, but also the delivery systems involved.
Yeah,
I mean, some people will argue that, you know, in the Malaysian system, we are functioning reasonably well with that, you know, 4.8%. And then, you know, but yet, you know, some people will actually argue that in the American system, we're spending 17.5%.
That's a little over the top.
That's over the top.
Absolutely.
I mean, is there any kind of like fine balance? Is there a kind of like a threshold that you say that is the ideal one? I mean, so people look to the Scandinavian countries and then to the UK, Australia. You know, is there such a thing as an ideal holy grail?
Well, arguably, you could say that Malaysia has sort of reached that holy land position, really, where you have around 52% being from public funds and then 48% private.
So that's what's happening now.
It's sort of, this is what's happening right now. And the problem here is that, like in the US, you have increasing healthcare costs. The benefits of having a much more a population that has a longer lifespan is that you are able to have them more productive and be able to be participating in the economy and contributing and pay taxes and so forth. But the drawback to that is that the older they are, they're living longer, yes. and therefore you have an aging population.
Right.
So the problem right now with the American healthcare system is that they have such a good quality of life that there are more people living beyond, you know, the average life expectancy, and those above 64 and above.
Well, I mean, last week we did a show, and then we realized that the Korean, for example, you know, they're going to live, they're going to be first ones to break the threshold of average life expectancy of 90.
Yeah.
So in a way, the Asians, we are taking over. So in some way, we have to kind of learn from the Americans, right? Okay. I mean, earlier on, the interesting thing you mentioned about in Malaysia, we kind of have that fine balance of a 50-50. You know, 50% of expenditure is spent in the private sector, 50% spent in public sectors. What is the balance in the American system, and then exactly what is the problem that they're facing now?
The problem right now, what they're facing is that there's a huge number of uninsured individuals. Now, when Obama came on board as president, they had around 54 million uninsured Americans.
Okay.
You know, this is a very significant number.
And who has been paying for all those people?
Nobody.
So basically, I mean, you know, before we went to the States, we're always told that, look, if you get run over by a car, you know, the first thing they will do is probably ask you for your credit card and that sort of thing.
Do you have insurance?
That's right, insurance, right? Okay. I mean, so therefore, before we travel there, we do that. And then, so out of that 17.5% of that GDP, I mean, presumably before Obamacare, a vast majority of them actually came from the insured patients.
Yes. What happens is that for many of the individuals who are uninsured, they have to pay out of pocket.
Right.
And very often what happens is that you end up with huge financial difficulties as a result of people paying out of pocket. And this results in either them not getting treated or, worse, falling into financial difficulties that result in them being dispossessed, being homeless.
And this was essentially what was identified by Obama.
Yeah. And that he fixed it with Obamacare.
Well, with Obamacare, what happened was that they had a little bit of runaway success. Initially, it was pretty crappy. And then after that, it picked up and it became better.
Why was it crappy?
Coverage wasn't as good as they initially thought because they had a bad website. Shows how websites are so important when you're dealing
even
with
for the Americans.
Yeah, but enrollment into
where
Obamacare.
Where's Silicon Valley again?
wondering, right? But basically what they wanted was that you have to get an insurance plan. Hook or by crook, you've got to have insurance, right? You go to the US, right? They tell you you've got to have insurance.
Right.
So these people were encouraged to have insurance. In fact, according to Obamacare, if you didn't have insurance, you'd be penalized.
Okay.
And that's really what...
So basically, risk rope in these 52-odd million people and say, look, we're going to fund this somehow or another, but you need to register and we need to give you somehow one level of insurance for this.
Yeah, you've got to have... Even
who was paying for all these?
Well, what if you can't afford it?
Well, if you couldn't afford it, what happens is that they would look at how much you earn. And the minimum... is that they would want to ensure that you have a mid-level insurance plan that would be able to cover most illnesses. And they worked it out that if you were 200% more than the poverty rate, you would be fully subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
If it was more than that, it would slowly increase. But basically at 6% of what you earn, you would be able to get, you know, you pay the minimum. Basically, you have to pay something. It's just even... a small amount, but as long as you paid and then you got insurance.
So essentially, it's just like a subsidized system, just like a social security subsidized system.
Well, I mean, yeah, definitely. Obamacare, what it looked at was that it looked at in terms of income, meaning the lesser you make, the more subsidies that you would actually have. The more that you made, the less subsidies that you would get, or you would have nothing at all. If you made more than 400% of the poverty rate, therefore, you don't need subsidies. It's not the Obamacare will not be giving any tax credits for you and so forth.
So, from a crappy system, it improved.
It definitely improved.
What were the improvements?
Well, they increased the number of people who were able to be insured. So, you start off with 54 million, it had ended up around 20 million who were able to be insured. And that's no mean feat. You know, we're talking about millions of people getting an insurance plan.
Well,
half when he came on board. And what has happened is that this is an achievement because of who is being covered. Now, people in the middle class, people like you and I and so forth, we can get insurance to some extent. But the issue that most medical practitioners will tell you, especially in the US, is what do you do about the poor and marginalized, vulnerable populations?
Or the one who have got existing complicated medical problems.
Yeah, pre-existing conditions, you know. So Obamacare, what happened was that they extended a program called Medicaid, which assists this group of people in this population, vulnerable populations. And it also dealt with one really important issue, which is pre-existing conditions. If you were taking insurance before Obamacare, you would be either charged a huge premium or they wouldn't even touch you at all because you had a pre-existing condition.
That's not insurable.
Yeah, it's not insurable. People are saying, we're not going to touch you. The moment we touch you, you go into something and then we have to pay for surgery in hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
So it ended up with a huge gap of individuals who were not being insured. So Obamacare, what it did was that it made it illegal for insurers to not consider insuring people with pre-existing conditions. And this is very important to note, because it enabled to close the gap with regards to people who have, you know, existing conditions like cancer, for example, or they have some heart condition. And this is where it's important to realize that in an insurance model, your premium will pay for somebody else's, you know, surgery, treatment, and so forth. And Obamacare depended on income levels. And this is different when you look at the current American Health Care Act, which has just been put forward by the Republicans just recently.
This is the Trump Care.
Well, I don't know if he's owned the Trump Care yet, but certainly AHCA is definitely the acronym they're using right now.
Right.
But basically what is being utilized now is age. Rather than dependent on income, which was Obamacare, now they're looking at age.
Right.
Meaning, the more you, the older you are, the more you pay.
Right.
So that means the ones who will be paying the least will be those who are youngest. And those.
How is that supposed to work out? Because normally you have it the reverse, actually. Mm. You subsidize the elderly. Now this is what's happening.
But that reminds me of our Malaysian system, right? When you're younger, your premium is a lot lower. When you reach a point when you are older, the Malaysian insurance company will give you a premium that you're uninsurable and most people drop out, which is a very difficult situation to penalise people.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not alien. And we have to be very realistic. We have to be honest about it too, is that when we hear this, it sounds outrageous. It sounds like you penalizing older people.
But it's a common practice.
It's actually a common practice. In fact, we do it here in Malaysia. So why should it be any different if they were to do it? And the thing that they're trying to do is going back to the earlier point, which is dealing with escalating deficit with regards to healthcare costs. They are looking at ways to cut down on the bill that the public money has to foot for healthcare.
Yeah.
This is one way. They've actually figured out through the CBO analysis that basically they will be able to save $300 billion over the course of 10 years.
Yeah. So, I'm finding this extremely
Which is the 3.2 trillion? Is that what you're talking about?
Out of the...
Wow.
You know, I always find health economics extremely fascinating. I mean, as a doctor, you know, the only thing that you think about is that patient in front of you. And then, you know, how are you going to solve the problems? You know, I used to work in NHS. With a stroke of your pen, you decide that, you know, that care goes to that person. And I really think that is a very simplified way of looking at healthcare, which is very unfair because at the end of the day, every single blood test, every single test that you organize or you do, you have to think of that someone has to pay for this, right? Okay. I mean, obviously, I mean, in a kind of a really simplified version of what I look at Obamacare was that initially you highlighted that, you know, 17.5 of GDP is spent in the United States and a vast majority prior to Obamacare were primarily the private sector. And then suddenly, you know, as Obama wanted to leave his legacy of actually, you know, kind of like narrowing the gaps between the rich and poor, because what you're describing was that the rich become richer and the poor, because of debt in latent and that sort of things, they then become poorer. So in order to equalize this was introduced. But number one, it's going to cost money? And then, you know, who has been paying for this? Is that why it's been criticized? And number two is that, was it because of the, you know, the people who were paying for it that actually were disputing this and actually thought that it was such a bad idea?
Well, at the end of the day, a lot of people feel that they shouldn't be paying for somebody else's healthcare, right? I mean, this is something that is a common belief, that if you're paying for anybody, it's yourself.
You're responsible for your own doing. Yeah. And then so, you know, we shouldn't subsidize everything
it's
else.
It's like saying the healthy should subsidize the unhealthy, isn't it?
It's something like
it's
that.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, but that's how insurance works.
It's not fair.
I mean, let's go back to basics, right? I mean, insurance works because everybody's contributing to a common pool, insurance pool. So the thing is about...
Well, actually, I dispute that, because insurance work is that you are contributing towards your own pool. Social Security works by everybody contributing towards a common pool, just like national insurance,
sure.
Right? Okay, but this is a national insurance versus private insurance.
But that's where, when you look at the American system, they have, on top of the private one, they have the national one, which is Medicaid. So
right.
They're contributing to that pool. And the idea is that the more people enrollees that you have, the more people who are paying to it, therefore you're able to have better coverage, better, you know, premiums that are lower. It's economies of scale, basically.
Yeah.
But there was a little bit of a problem with Obamacare, because later on, when they had too many people beyond the projected numbers that they expected, it became necessary for the insurers to actually increase the premiums.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the more people that you have, the more people you have to cover. So if they fall ill and so forth, the volume,
more the payout,
the more they actually had to pay out, right?
Yeah.
So what people felt very dissatisfied with Obamacare towards the end of his presidency was that they ended up having to pay more in terms of premiums towards that later part, instead of the an amount that they were expected to pay when they first signed on. So this is what Trump has inherited, basically.
Just to call it the mess. He's been describing it as a mess.
He's been describing it as a mess. But, you know, when you think about how many people have now got insurance, where in a country, by the way, where a friend of mine, I was in the US for a while, a friend of mine who cut his hand with a knife and ended up having to go to the emergency to get stitches, ended up paying $200 for basically four stitches.
Right.
That's like $50 a stitch, you know? So imagine if you were to fork that kind of money out from your own pocket. That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that people have insurance in the US, right? So by the time he ended his presidency, there were 20 million people less who were left out, you know, and they were covered. So it's important that was their pre-existing conditions, the issue concerning a much more wider base for Medicaid and a better future for people who are wanting to get treated for chronic illnesses, you know, that basically would cost a lot of money. So what they're trying to do with the ACHA is to basically address issues that were brought up by the Trump campaign, which is, for example, people were very upset that they have to pay for other people. They were very upset that you get penalized. Even if you didn't want insurance, you were penalized for doing so, for making that decision. So when you look at what ACHA is dealing with, it deals with individual freedoms. That if you don't want insurance, then you don't need to get insurance.
Mm.
If you want to pay more for insurance, you can pay more for insurance. But the idea is that fewer subsidies are available in the system. So what they have also as a marked difference in the current proposed plan is the subsidies that they provide for each state. Now, in each of these states, they have an allocation that they give to subsidize those who are in those states who are being subsidized, right? So under Obamacare, it was an open-ended commitment, meaning as long as they had people under insurance, they would be required to pay for the treatment of the people in the program. Under the current ACHA, under Trump Care, they would actually have a cap per capita, meaning each person enrolled in the program for that state would have a dollar sign against that person's name. That means you can only use up to that amount or subsidized for that amount, and after that, you don't have it anymore.
Okay. I'm a bit lost, but we'll go to
no, so I've got 2 points now. Yeah. Trump Care has changed. I mean, just to make a comparison, Trump Care is now looking at age, meaning the older you are, the more you pay in terms of insurance. And two, now there could be a cap for how much you will be able to claim for various illnesses. So that's interesting. That's two already. We'll come back and find out more. And also the impact on the rest of the world, because we, you know, can talk about Trump's growing anti-vaccine sentiments and his
policies.
That's
when it gets exciting, the conversation.
Yes, how will this impact the Malaysian healthcare system? So we'll come back and find out up next. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 0377 109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 0162019000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me today. He's a little lost at the moment because our topic today is so technical with Azrul Khalib.
A little lost. It's a slight understatement.
Azrul, manager for external relations from the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, better known as IDEAS. We're trying to just now just establish the difference between Obamacare and Trump Care. The objective of this show is actually to figure out some of the decisions that, you know, are being proposed under Trump Care and that effect on the rest of the world and in Malaysia as well.
Just like everyone says, like, when the US sneezes, the rest of the world will catch cold.
Correct. Right? But, you know, as Azrul is pointing out, a lot of things that Trump is actually implementing is not very different from what is existing in principle, even here on this side of the world.
That's actually a common complaint right now amongst more conservative Republicans, that what he's proposing, well, what the Republicans are proposing, is not enough, because they came into office saying that they would repeal and replace Obamacare. This looks like Obamacare light. So they say it's not good enough. We've got to get rid of everything.
Get rid of the whole thing. Yeah. Is that possible, though, Azrul?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, one thing.
Well, I mean, how do you uninsure somebody who's 20 million Americans who are already.
How sustainable is that?
Yeah, but you can uninsure them.
You just kind of say, sorry, we made a. Yeah. You know, that was a, we They'll do a U-turn.
They will say to you, okay, now you've got to pay $3,000. Where previously you were paying $1,000 for yearly coverage, you will drop out the program.
Sure.
So it will come to that, you know, where you will end up
indeed
disenfranchising.
Yep. So what else, Azrul, has Trump got to deal with as a result of, you know, the disadvantages of Obamacare that he now has to undo? I mean, the cost is definitely one. He's trying his level best to reduce that $3.2 trillion that they're actually spending. And by increasing getting the older people to pay more, in a way, it will bring it down.
Yeah.
Okay. What else?
Well,
having a cap for subsidies, okay.
There's definitely going to be a cap for subsidies, but more importantly, the mindset here is that you're responsible for your own healthcare and that you've got to be made responsible for that. So,
Wow, that's utopia, isn't it? Don't you think, George? I mean, if everybody did that, we wouldn't have a problem.
I do such a thing.
The world.
Well, it has to be a fine balance, right? And it's like, you know, I think, you know, early on, you know, we were talking about different healthcare systems and things. And we have to look at our neighbors who's known that Singapore, for example, they have this MediSave system that, you know, throughout your life, you just kind of save into a kitty that will eventually go for your healthcare. But yet the government kind of subsidizes it, a bit like EPF kind of things. And it seems to be kind of working well. And each countries have our own little ways of working that, fine balance. And it seems like whenever you have an American system that actually is swinging from one end to another, it is just going to be disruptive.
Yeah. Do you think that we are sort of blowing all of these things out of proportion because it's Trump?
No.
It makes sense, some of it, but
Trump, his ideology, if he has one, is is one thing. But there's also...
That's it. You're barred from going to the U.S. now. It's like, you know,
I'm going there next week.
No, I know. The travel ban will include...
his people, especially his health secretary, is going to have to be realistic. And there is a political cost to this. You know, when you think about who we described as being vulnerable and being the population that will bear the brunt of many of these changes, it's actually his base.
The older people.
The ones who are actually in the vulnerable population, those who are living in the Rust Belt of the United States. You know, these are people who actually voted him in.
Yeah.
You know, so they are the first ones who are going to feel the sting of this if it was to be signed into law. So if we look at things that are good, now, this has maintained a few things from Obamacare, which, for example, coverage of children. So if you have children, your insurance can also cover them up to 26 years of age. And he didn't get rid of that. That's a good thing. The pre-existing conditions that we spoke about earlier, he has maintained that too in the proposed plan. They haven't gotten rid of that either. Obamacare instituted a number of new taxes. You know, at the end of the day, but more coverage, more people enrolled under Medicare, you've got to pay for this, right? So they instituted more tax. Some of these taxes will continue on under the current proposed plan, but they will be eliminated later on. One thing that's not too good is that the expansion of Medicaid will actually stop in year 2020, meaning after 2020, they will not expand it anymore. That means the enrollment will stop. That's not very good because there will be new people who are vulnerable.
Yeah.
There will be increasingly poor people. There will be people who are considered marginalized, and they will not be able to benefit from Medicaid because it will be stopped in terms of new enrollees. So this is not very good. But it's important to state here that this is something that is still evolving.
Mm.
There's a
Everything
lot of
is evolving at
Everything
the moment.
They still, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has released the analysis. The analysis has shown many of the things that I've spoken to you about. And they have to digest this. They can't sign it straight into law. Mm-hmm. They have to negotiate the votes. And very often, you will find that many of the people who were elected into office today, in the Congress and Senate, actually boasted about their ability to expand coverage of insurance to the poorer people in their states, and they got elected on the basis of that support. So if you take away their support, so if you take away the insurance, they're going to be very upset. And re-election is only 2 years away.
Yeah.
So they might not be able to come back into office. So they have to negotiate. So they might be a camel at the end of the day, an animal built on committee, right? Which you will have, but it won't necessarily be as you see it today.
Right.
There's a lot of permutations. The same with Obamacare. Obamacare, when it first was rolled out, it looked different than what eventually became law.
Yeah.
So it's important to state that and to give Trump the benefit of a doubt here with regards to, you know, position that he might have on this particular plan.
Indeed.
Let's look at the impact of the rest of the world. Yes. Malaysia, for an example.
Sure. Which is what many listeners want to know. What's it got to do with us?
On Trump's healthcare plan, I mean, one of the things he intends to do is to sort of lower drug prices, if it's possible. Now, do you think it's possible?
It will impact us at the end of the day.
Well, it's a good thing, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a good thing. I mean, if you look at the cost of healthcare, many a time you will find that a lot of it is with regards to the purchasing
of medication.
And medication, even from Panadol all the way up to the most expensive cardiovascular-related drugs.
Well, actually, at the moment, the most expensive is cancer drugs.
Cancer drugs. I mean,
hugely expensive. I mean, you know, in my line of work, we have patients, you know, the newer versions of these, you know, prostate cancer drugs can cost, you know, up to 20,000 ringgit per month.
Yeah.
Is that biologics?
These are, you know, the targeted therapy, and then, you know, they can cost up to that, and, you know, and it's beyond reach for anyone.
Absolutely.
At the moment, right?
I mean, hepatitis C, the generics cost $12,000 for a dosage for 3 months.
Yeah, because at the moment, we have these kind of like branded protections. It's patented up to a point, and then it becomes generic. But that is a long period of time. We're talking about like 15 years or so and beyond. So how is Trump going to lower the prices?
Well, one of the things that they're trying to do, and this is where he came into office saying that Medicaid has bargaining power. Because when you have a lot of people, a volume, the argument is that with that volume, you can say, I can get a better price because I have a lot of people on this particular
Makes
drug.
Sense.
Makes sense, right? It's market. Yeah. But unfortunately, his predecessor, George W. Bush, back in 2003, I think, actually signed a law that states that they are unable to use that Medicaid pressure to negotiate for better drug
prices. All right, so it's kind of like a cartel that it's all fixed price it's not negotiable.
It's
all right.
Law.
They can't use Medicaid for that purpose, so they have to actually negotiate separately. But the point here is that what he's trying to do, especially with newer innovator drugs, is to get rid of phase 2 and phase 3 of clinical trials.
Oh.
So
is that even recommended, George? I mean, I'm sure there are dangers in that. There's a reason why we have stage 2 and 3.
Phase 2 and 3...
So he's trying to cut corners in some ways.
Yeah. So phase 2 and 3 deal with the issue of effectiveness of the drug. Phase 1 is really on safety issues. The concern here is that, sure, you'll have the drug fast-tracked into the market, but they might be very much useless, you know, because they don't have any benefits. You don't have the phase 2 and phase 3. But phase 3 is actually the most expensive part of a clinical trial.
Yeah, because you need to actually have a group of people, cohorts, and you need to monitor them over a period of time versus placebo, and then you need to constantly monitor these people.
Yeah,
and so that's costly.
Yeah, it's costly. So,
but taking that out, George, I mean, what do you think?
Well, the data will be meaningless.
Right,
because if you don't have a fixed number of months or years in order to compare it versus randomized control over a period of time, there is no meaningful data on efficacy.
That's why when he proposed this, people did raise their eyebrows concerning it, because at
everyone thought he's joking.
Mine almost got stuck up there. I was like, what?
The FDA exists for a reason, you know, and certainly these processes that are put in place are to make sure that whatever drug goes into the market is something that is able to have, you know, both safety, you know, efficacy, and is able to have sufficient benefits for people actually, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
So he wants to fast-track drugs, which is the common complaint of most of the drug companies, is that it takes too long
and too expensive.
Yeah, and too expensive. And when you look at the patient, because when you look at patients are waiting for this drug to get into the market, and they're waiting and waiting, and it still hasn't gotten past phase 3, you know, or phase 2. So there is some good intentions here when they're putting this, except that you can't do shortcuts when it comes to these things sometimes. So
indeed,
it's something that needs to be considered very carefully if
absolutely
they decide to do that.
So I agree.
Yeah. When it comes to
because the drug can, you know, can have adverse effects.
No. Safety is no phase 1, but now we're looking at it, the drugs might not have no impact at all, right? Yeah. Okay, right, anyway.
But that's one. But if one thing we have to realize is that we actually have an advantage compared to the United States, and many of the countries that have healthcare systems which are nationalized, is that you have the strength of the population to bargain, to negotiate with the drug companies. And that's something that Trump doesn't have because he's constrained
because
by law.
Constrained by law, yeah.
So Malaysia, for example, should be able to negotiate a better drug prices because we basically have, you know, nationalized healthcare system. So this is something that at the end of the day, when you look at answering that question, can drug prices be lowered? It is possible. It depends on quite a number of factors, but most importantly is the ability for the countries to negotiate. However, I would want to state here that we have to be able to take into consideration the R&D cost towards introducing a new drug, an innovative drug.
Yeah, because the pricing always argued by pharmaceutical company is that, you know, they probably just have one successful drug after they trialed, you know, 20 different ones.
Yeah. I mean, let's face it, they have to be able to recover costs. And that cost could be substantial. There's a number of years that, of investment. They need to be able to get that. Now, the thing is that the reality is manufacturing of drugs can cost just a few cents.
Right.
Let's face it.
Yeah.
You know,
the blue pill actually costs cents to make. However, after all the trials and marketing and everything and doctors' conferences is what Mira is looking at. And then, you know, eventually it has to be costed, you know, into that that sort of like the prices, you know.
Exactly.
And then, you know, and per tablet.
But it's called continual medical education.
But also,
that's right, yeah.
Most importantly is that just as it is in insurance, those who are better off have to pay for those who are being subsidized or being given discounts. So if you think about the world being a very large market,
yes,
you know, those in developed countries will be paying more, certainly, than people who are, say, in Indonesia or India or Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how it would work, right? Because basically the costs will be spread out for even a company when they look at it. And this is where it's a little bit problematic for a country like Malaysia. Because we are, I'm not even sure whether we're in transition mode anymore, but we are now an upper middle income country. Therefore, when you look at our GDP, when we boast about being a developed, heading towards
2020.
Well, now 2020 is moving towards TN50, and yes. You know, and I mean, with the so much money coming in, and yes. And infrastructure and the GDP being what it is and everything, the question would then be, why cannot Malaysians afford to pay higher than what you would get, say, in India or in Indonesia or Cambodia? Why are we insisting on prices that are comparable to that?
Yes.
So there's it's almost a Hobbes choice here, you know, because we want to claim that we're better developed, but that comes with a whole package of being a developed country or upper middle income country, as in this case.
Okay.
So it's tricky for us.
Sure. We'll come back and find out a little bit more. Up next, I think the TPP is the last one. Trump
yes.
is actually planning to get rid of it now. How
what
will that
planning?
Impact?
I thought he's done it already.
Well, Azrul from Ideas, or Ideas generally, has been for the TPP. So with Trump sort of getting rid of TPP, you know, what are your thoughts? That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. This is our Health and Living segment. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist. It's a Friday. Together with Azrul Muhammad Khalib.
Stunned and drenched.
Manager for External Relations from the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs. We're actually trying to figure out the Trump Care, or the proposals that are being made under Trump Care as opposed to Obamacare, and how that affects the rest of the world for people like us here in Malaysia. Azrul, TPP, I mean, there have been plans by the Trump administration to get rid of the TPP. Ideas, the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, has always been for the TPP. So what's your stand on that now?
Well, despite the fact that America has withdrawn from the TPP, we are very much still in our conviction that basically what was promoted and encouraged and even imposed through Malaysia's participation in TPP, which involves quite a number of reforms and liberalisation moves towards different sectors like procurement, intellectual property and so forth. These are very much still required and for Malaysia's economy to actually compete with the big boys. At the end of the day, these are not bad for Malaysia. It's actually good. In fact, when you consider the fact that some of it was based on issues of human rights, those reforms address some inequalities and certain uncomfortable practices in things like human resource labor law. So those things we should be able to continue on. And I think you will find that if Malaysia were to continue on with that, it would actually make Malaysia a much more attractive place to invest for foreign investors to come in and put their money. Because it's not about America. It's about a regional collaboration to actually address competitiveness and also ensure that they're able to access each other's markets.
So biologics was one of those that, you know, was in question when it came to the TPP. So what's your stand on it now?
Well, it's still very much the same. I think when we look at wanting to introduce new innovative drugs into the Malaysian market, we need to make sure that the patent protections are there, intellectual property is respected, and
we don't have that now?
We do have it.
But is it not regulated or is it not adhered to?
We do have it. It's just that we need to strengthen that further because at the end of the day, we need to address the situation. For example, you mentioned about cancer drugs just now.
Right.
Did you know that quite a few of the cancer drugs that are the latest that are available in Thailand and Singapore are not available in Malaysia?
Right.
You know, and one of the reasons why it's not available in Malaysia is because there are issues concerning IP that have not yet been addressed, you know. So people are reluctant to introduce new products into an environment where it could very well happen that their product be ripped off, you know, photocopied or reproduced for very little or nothing at all paid. So people are concerned about that, and we need to make sure that Malaysia is able to compete.
So at the moment, without TPP, the Malaysian law is not consolidated enough for a foreign country to respect that and say, look, you know, the law is robust, so I'm going to invest in this country?
No, it's just that Malaysia's IP environment right now, especially when it comes to drugs, is good. But it needs to be strengthened further.
Right.
Because we need to have the next generation drugs in the country. And we don't have that because we don't have that guarantee that allows for people to be comfortable enough to put it in.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I just as a layperson, you know, when it comes to TPP, when it was negotiated, it didn't really mean that much to me. When it was abolished, it didn't quite mean that much to me. As a kind of like a regular listener in Klang Valley, what did we lose out with Obama, Trump kind of striking this off with his executive order? Has Malaysia lost out many things out of this? Because clearly ideas supported it. Can you name me five things that we lost out because of this?
Oh, putting me on spot there, man.
Well, I mean, just as a regular listener, you know, I want to know, you know, did it really matter to me that much?
Well, one of the things that we want to be able to ensure is that we have the best possible products in our country, right? That we're able to afford them, we're able to access them.
And we don't now.
And right now, there are some things that are not able to be brought into the country because they are either taxed, or, you know, there's a levy put onto them that is put simply because they are foreign product.
Okay.
There are limitations as to what kind of product because there's protectionism. And there's also the issue that it cannot compete because there are carve-outs or biasness towards, you know, protecting certain sectors or communities who are doing business.
Right.
So it's when you have TPP, a lot of these barriers would actually be
Essentially, what you're saying is that, you know, look, if you want to play with the big boys, you need to have certain standards that is uniform across the board, and TPP ensure that you are in that ball game. And then at the moment, it's a little bit non-adhere to, it's a bit non-consolidated.
Free markets, would you
but
say?
Free markets. Malaysia has a free market, but it's not free enough.
Yep.
People are scared here of competing.
Right.
And we tend to exist in this bubble where we feel that, we seem to be competing, but actually we have artificial prices because we have subsidies here, subsidies there.
That we agree.
Yeah, we're not allowing for companies that should not be still alive to die so that a new one, a better one.
Right.
We learn from our own mistakes. Instead, we're paying for some of these mistakes.
Okay.
Of course, this is not necessarily healthcare. This is
everything else.
Yeah,
but inefficiency.
And TPP will prevent that?
No, TPP will open up the market so that there's competition.
Everyone has to be on the ball.
On the same level. But also, it means a good thing for the consumer because you get two things. One is that you get to pick the best possible product in a market that has diversity, there's more choices. Two, it could be cheaper than what you're paying now. Now, that's the most important thing for people to hear, because right now, when it comes to healthcare, when you're paying out of pocket for so many line items that, you know, you're going to be ending up having to pay for, with TPP, for example, you could have better drugs in, cheaper drugs, the competition. As a result, the free market forces could actually cause even the pharmaceutical companies to revise their prices because there's now a competition.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, we have to remember that the consumer or the patient or the individual actually almost ideally sets the tone or the market. And we're not using that strength or power enough to actually do that. We're almost like at the mercy. We're so disempowered. Oh, we can't do anything because we're only the rakyat and everything. But actually, it's not true. When you have the purchasing power, you actually sort of have influence.
You're the boss.
I mean, it's demand and supply, isn't it?
Yeah, but when it comes to healthcare, it's important for sustainability. Malaysia is coming up to a critical point where people...
It's like a crossroad.
It's a crossroad, yeah. People think healthcare in this country costs 1 ringgit. It doesn't. 99.8% of your healthcare bill, your visit to the GH or any of the clinics, is actually subsidized by the Malaysian taxpayer.
Yes.
How long do you think that's going to be? And this is a critical point because we need to learn from the experiences of the United States and how they're dealing with how they are financing and trying to find that magic formula in order to apply it to our country. Because at the end of the day, we want to continue to pay one ringgit, except that we want someone else to pay for it, right?
But yeah. I mean, that's well said, really. I mean, today we had 45 minutes of discussion about, you know, Obamacare, Trumpcare, and that sort of thing. But what it boils down to is that we learn from their model and see how that fits our model.
For
because at the moment, that whole subsidies is simply not going to be sustainable.
Yeah. And guess what? That one ringgit price is since the 84. That price has been there since 84. And you know we're going to have to change it soon. And most importantly, we have to change our mindset as to how we look at insurance.
But this is like a political time bomb, really, isn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, in many countries, nobody dares to touch healthcare, like NHS and anything like that. It's because it's just like a, you know, political time bomb. If you touched it, you know, you are, you know, because this is what has been keeping the nation going, the health of the nation going.
Yeah. Social Security is the third rail of American politics. You touch it, you die, is what they say.
Yes.
Same thing with Malaysia. We have social protection mechanisms in place. We have welfare safety nets, but they're not there forever. And they certainly can't be paid for through valuations that date back to the early 90s or even 10, 15 years ago. We need to update them. Most importantly, in order for us to maintain the level and quality of access, which is one of the best in the world, by the way, that patients have to the healthcare system in this country, we need to reform and relook at the way we're financing it. Because at the end of the day, to the government, to the people of this country, it is all about the dollars and cents.
Yeah, and I think our Minister of Health will agree with you. He does. He has admitted that, you know, it's not a sustainable model. But something he said sort of got me when he said the healthy should subsidize the unhealthy, which I didn't think was fair. But, you know, that's up for open for debate, really.
But that is the way it works, you
yes,
know.
That is the way it works, unfortunately, isn't it? Get healthy, man, so I don't have to pay for you.
But in NHS, it gets a little bit severe. I think they were restricting surgeries for the obese.
That's a little over the top. I mean, you look at the NHS, it's not perfect either. They're having issues as well. So you're right. We need to learn. We need to adapt and you know, implement what will work for us.
But generally, a good thing that perhaps the government can consider, and even the Malaysian public, is to invest in your own healthcare. Is that you need to be healthy in order to continue to be able to
well
work.
Well said.
You know, to be able to contribute back to the nation. And most importantly, investment today results in savings for tomorrow in the years ahead, where you could save from, you know, having cardiovascular disease at a younger age. It could be later, perhaps. You could actually not be saddled with diabetes, for example, or type 2 diabetes, which if you look at the country's statistics in terms of morbidity mortality survey, where basically we're looking at the majority of, I think it was like 60% of the population being overweight and obese.
You know? We went through that many times.
Yeah. And, you know, it's this is something that the minister, I feel for him, that he has to address the situation where the majority of the population are falling in an unhealthy category. How do you do that?
Yep.
How do you get them to be healthy and realize that?
He told me that
healthy?
I should talk to the people as media. He said, you don't talk. I can't talk to them because then they'll think I have an agenda. So he said, the media, speak to them. But I don't think talking is going to help.
Well, he's going on TV to disseminate this. And Mira tells him that, no, nobody watches TV anymore.
Anyway, thank you very much for joining us today. Azro, would you have a message, this whole Obama-Trump care? I mean, you know, forget about America, but really Malaysia, what would be your message?
Well, my message is that we have to look at the way we're managing our own healthcare system, because we've modelled it after the NHS, after the UK system. But today what's happened is that there are escalating costs. There's a bigger bill to pay. There are more non-communicable diseases. There are lifestyle diseases. There's more and more people who are increasingly unhealthy. There's also an ageing population. All in all, we have a bigger bill to pay for healthcare. We've got to figure out a way how we're going to be able to pay for it. It's not so much about the dollars and cents in this case. It's about the people who need help. the people vulnerable, and as was stated at the very onset, the patient themselves. We don't want it to be a situation where we have to just leave them on the side of the road because they cannot be treated because nobody's going to pay for them. We have to avoid that, and we have to look back at the need to protect people who are most vulnerable.
Well, my final message is I need to lie down now.
It was way too much.
That's right, way too much. Like information
George.
Overload.
Poor fella.
Poor brain. My poor brain is exploding.
Thank you, Azra. I mean, that was very enlightening indeed. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. That was Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Azra Mohammad Khalib, manager for external relations from the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.